Jurassic Time had the wonderful opportunity to have a conversation with Dino Don Lessem. He was a staple of the 1990s, having written over 50 books throughout the years about dinosaurs and other subjects. He's the founder of the Dinosaur Society and the Jurassic Foundation, aided the excavation and reconstruction of the Argentinosaurus and Giganotosaurus, and currently specializes in making scientifically accurate full-size animatronic dinosaurs for exhibits. He was also consulted for Disney's Animal Kingdom theme park and their dinosaur film and attraction. However, before all of that, he was involved in the production of Jurassic Park, its ride for Universal Studios, and the highly popular exhibits that traveled across museums. This conversation was conducted over the phone between Derek Davis and Don Lessem, and the sound quality reflects this. While an effort has been made to improve it as much as possible, apologies in advance for anything inaudible. And now, Jurassic Time presents this thorough and engaging look into the man who has been part of popular and scientific prehistory for decades.
Hello, Derek.
Hey, Don, how's it going?
All right.
Well, I amassed quite a bit of questions for you.
Okay.
Yeah, I hope that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
How did you become a dinosaur expert?
I started out actually as a Chinese art historian, but I was colorblind, so that was a poor career choice. I went to graduate school to study gorillas, and so I was actually going to write the authorized biography of Diane Fossey, the woman who died in the Gorillas in the Mist.
Yeah.
And somebody wrote a quickie novel first, a quickie account first, almost a novel, instead of a biography of her. But I decided that I really liked the science writing more than the researching. So I went to work for the Boston Globe newspaper, primarily. And then freelance, I was working for the magazine section as well as the science section. So the magazine section had lots of room for stories, and the editor there said, I think that was like 86, that I should do a story about Jack Horner and Bob Bakker, who were then in their primes. And she said, there are these two kind of nut guys, and you should go write a profile of them. And I frankly hadn't thought about dinosaurs since I was obsessed with them when I was a kid, like other kids, until about age 8. I used to go to the American Museum of Natural History in New York and give tours when I was 5. Nobody asked me to, but I just liked explaining all the dinosaurs. So they sent me out on this story, and it was coincident with my getting a fellowship that exists for mid-career science journalists at MIT. And that meant a lot of free time where I didn't have to write a story every 10 minutes. So I could really immerse myself in the subject. And of course, whatever else they are, Bakker and Horner are fascinating characters. And to go out, I think we were in Montana and Utah, and actually participate in the excavations and see the aspect of the science that I hadn't really thought about, not just the dinosaurs themselves. But it's not brain surgery. You know, you can go out and find bones yourself. So that was tremendously exciting. And I decided, instead of changing subjects every week, because I have an ADD personality, I would do different things with dinosaurs, which means, you know, every few years I sort of change what I'm doing. First children's books, first an adult book about sort of summing up what's going on all around the world. I decided to go to pretty much every dinosaur dig there was, from Mongolia to Alaska, because there are only like 35 people in the world who dig dinosaurs.
Wow.
Nobody read that book, so I realized all my audience is children, so I started writing kids' books and trying to make them... Actually, first I wrote an essay for the New York Times book review section about how bad all the children's books were, because none of them had this current scientific information. They were sort of written by librarians who read another dinosaur book that they had seen in the library. So I, you know, made this kind of like soapbox lecture in the article, and nobody picked up on it. So I decided, okay, I'm talking to myself. I should write these books. So I think I've written about 50 now, and I try and provide something that's not found elsewhere, either how a scientific question is answered, how an exploration goes, a really comprehensive encyclopedia, a geographic distribution about dinosaurs as an atlas. So did a lot with those things. And then one of my fellow graduates from this program at MIT was, and still is, like the Dragon Queen is her nickname, the head of, her name's Paula Apsel, head of NOVA, public television series.
Yeah.
So I convinced her that they should make some documentaries about, one, the finding of the second biggest T-Rex, which X Corner had done. It's now the, quote, nation's T-Rex because it was sent to the Smithsonian. It is in their new halls. So I hosted a documentary about T-Rex and discovered that I'm not very good at that either. but it was fun. And then wrote some for Discovery Channel about the Steganotosaurus. And I got involved in the finding of these new giant dinosaurs in Argentina, very coincidentally, after Jurassic Park. So when I was working at the back working at the Globe, they said, there's this new book coming out, Jurassic Park. And nobody knew what it was then. And Michael Crichton wrote this book. Why don't you interview Michael Crichton? So I had just been on all these digs around the world and seen that these scientists had no money. I mean, they literally were giving me the shirts off their back, because when I went to the Arctic right after being in China, I kind of forgot that it's not so warm. And the only clothes I could find were in Prudhoe Bay, all the way up in the Arctic Circle, were purple. And I didn't realize they were because I'm colorblind. So I show up as an excavation dressed entirely like Bozo the Clown. And so they not only, you know, let me participate in their excavations, but, you know, literally put the clothes on my back. And I got on a soapbox for that, because there's all this money made in from dinosaurs, and they don't come from fantasy. They come from somebody's hard work. Yeah. And those guys don't get royalties. The dinosaurs don't get royalties either. So I started a nonprofit called the Dinosaur Society, and I had a children's newspaper associated with it called Dino Times. And so I thought, well, let me try this out on Crichton. And he was a very generous guy, very private, and very blunt. And he said, you don't know what the hell you're doing. I said, that's right. He said, look, I'll give you some money, not a lot, but I'll give you some money, and I'll try to get you going in this. And I said, okay, whatever you say. And then a few weeks later, I got a call from a producer, like the number three associate producer, for Jurassic Park. He said, we have this movie in development, and Michael spoke to Steven, and they would like you to participate in this and your charity. I said, okay. So we never discussed money, because I was trying to raise money for the charity, so I didn't want to be paid. They liked that very much.
Of course.
I didn't want money. And, you know, they really wanted names attached to sort of somehow give a patina of science to these projects. But, you know, it's a novel. It's exciting. They, you know, the kinds of things that I got asked were, you know, how do I get amber to put in the cane for Attenborough to carry, or what's, you know, what's, we have these toy partners. Would you go see Kenner Toys and make sure that the dino damage looks realistic on our dinosaur toys?
They had
a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh my God.
So they were fun things to do.
Yeah. Random was fun.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I wrote some of the movie, but it's only a portion of one line. So I don't think I'm exactly a writer. When I showed up the first time, I was on the set where they were in the Mojave Desert filming the supposed Sweetwater, Montana scenes, you know? And the people in the dig itself, aside from the actors, the main actors, were all extras dressed in button-down shirts. And I was standing way in the back, you know, because I didn't have anything to do with the third associate producer. And Spielberg's up in the front in his chair, and he's actually working the camera sometimes. And there are 100, literally 100 people around him. And they've got all these lights on to change the lighting in the daytime, which is amazing. And I said to the associate producer, boy, they don't dress like that. They wear dirty T-shirts. They haven't had a bath in a week. She said, well, where are we going to get dirty T-shirts? And I said, well, I have a whole suitcase of dirty t-shirts. So we redressed them. And then Laura Dern was saying something. Do you remember there's a screen that the guy taps and he's trying to see the skeleton?
Yeah.
On the screen, which the technology does not exist. But Laura Dern was saying, oh, it's this dinosaur. It took about 1 million years to get like this with the tail curved up and the head curved back. I said, this is bullshit. That's what happens. You get rigor mortis. If you had a tail and a head like that, you would curl up too in a day. So the woman walked away from me, the producer, and I thought, oh, shit, I'm like, I haven't even gotten to eat the shrimp off the buffet there, and I'm going to be out of here. And so she went up, and then I see her talking to Spielberg, and he called the cop here, whoever said that. So rewrite the line. So we rewrote the line. And then I ended up talking to him a fair amount because I was the only person who didn't want something. You know, like, he's a very interesting person, but I didn't have any, I'm not in the movie business, and I never will be. So I think he found that a little relaxing because everybody else was, like, sucking up to him all the time. And, like, I traded hats with him at one point, you know, to give him a Dinosaur Society hat. And some, you know, hanger on there, which there were so many, said, how'd you get seen with Pat? You know, like, and then she said, you know, you'll never see him again. I said, well, that's okay. You know, I enjoyed meeting him, but yeah, you're right. And she was wrong because I was at a urinal once, Universal, and he came up to the next urinal. So we continued our relationship.
That's great.
But along the way, I'd mentioned that I'd like to make an exhibit to show everything that's wrong with this movie, that you won't listen to me and change. And he said, okay. So Universal, of course, has no interest in cooperating, but they're afraid of Spielberg.
Yeah.
So they made all the sets and props available. And actually, the exhibit was put together by a friend of mine who's cast skeleton of T-Rex that is blown up by the living T-Rex in the final scene, you know, in the visitor center.
Yeah.
That guy, his name is Peter May, said, you know, Don, help me get together this exhibit. And so we got Spielberg's permission and we gave Universal a very high royalty, 20% of all the revenue of the exhibit on the condition that they donated it all. Right. Which they hated. But we raised $3 million for dinosaur research out of touring this exhibit. And it went on and, you know, toured for like 7 years. And then we did a Lost World exhibition as well, which I think was actually a better exhibit. Because that one I did with the American Museum of Natural History. The studio wanted it to open there the day before the movie did, to get more press for the movie, which was a good idea. And, so that had more science content, more skeletons, more information, and more entertainment. We had Jeff Goldblum, you know, narrate these videos for us, and he was great. The actors were a trip. It was great. The actors know who is the consultant, and I guess if they have a question, they know they can call me. So one night I got a call. This is Sam Neill. I said, oh, hi. he said, send me some VHS of David Attenborough. I said, why? David Attenborough presents dinosaurs. He's not a scientist. You're playing a guy from Montana. He said, I asked you for David Attenborough. Send me David Attenborough. So that was my first and last conversation with him. The one person who was great was, of course, Attenborough's extremely nice and not so involved. You know, his role was not huge. He wasn't there all the time. I mean, he was, you know, a million other projects. But I really wanted to meet him because I knew David. Who was a really nice guy, very personable, and knew a lot about the family from interviewing David and stuff. So, and I, you know, of all the people there, I was probably more impressed with him than anybody by reputation. So I was a little nervous to go meet him, and someone said, well, let's go in his trailer. So I wanted to try and think of something different to say to him than, you know, like, congratulations on Gandhi, that was a great movie, or, you know, something else that he's heard before. So I'd seen this movie, Dam Busters, a long time ago, which was a British World War II kind of propaganda movie, but a true story about how they developed a bomb that could skip its way onto a dam and then blow up. And it has a lot of famous actors in it. So when I walked in, I said, you know, so Richard, I loved your performance in the Dam Busters. And he said, oh, thank you so much. That was Sir Michael Redgrave. It wasn't him. So I immediately came across as a moron. Laura Dern was charming. Goldblum, I was sitting by the side of the set while they're filming, and he is called onto the set, you know, but meanwhile he's waiting, and he sees me, and he starts talking about his analysis and how it was going, which is not something you hear from a stranger that often.
Yeah.
So he is exactly who he is on screen, off screen. Very friendly, full of energy and excitement, and he loved dinosaurs, and he volunteered to do these intro videos for our exhibition for free. Came to the exhibit opening. He was a lovely person. Crichton had told me, it's the first day you're on a set, it's fascinating. The second day and thereafter, every day is intensely boring. And it's true, because it's over and over and over again. It takes them a long time to set up everything. And so once you've seen how it's all done, it's amazing. Then it's more and more of the same.
Yeah.
What else am I thinking about this? Bob the Bacher.
Yeah, I was going to ask about him. He always mentions how he was involved with the movie.
Yeah, it drives me crazy because he was absolutely uninvolved with the movie. He knew some of the artists, and they would ask him advice early on. But he would bill himself as being an advisor. And Horner, who was the principal advisor, and quite involved, but made him furious, and therefore can make Spielberg angry. So that's why in Lost World, Bacher gets the Bacher character, appears, and gets promptly killed.
Yeah.
That was all inspired by how annoying everybody found Bob Bacher's self-promotion.
So that's perfect, because I always wondered like if that was intentional, but now I know. Yeah, it was intentional, like to look like him, and there was a reason right behind it.
and he takes great pride in that, like that, you know, that he sort of doesn't get the nuance that they wanted him dead. Yeah, and the person who was I found the most personable, genuine, was Kathy Kennedy. You know, Spielberg's longtime collaborator back to E.T. and stuff as a producer. And she just was a terrific person. And if I was to keep up with anybody, I did somewhat in writing with her, but she's really the only person from the movie who I kept up with in any way. It reminded me, this is a funny story. Sorry. On the set, I'm trying to think of things that people don't know.
Yeah.
I came in one morning, and there in the jungle there is a guy being eviscerated by a raptor, and his guts are spilling out, you know, with blood and packet opening and stuff, you know, just disgusting. And cool. So yeah. I said, what's going on here? This is kind of a family movie. No. And they said, no, this is for Steven's personal collection.
What?
So I don't know what he did with that stuff. But,
so are you talking about the scene at the very beginning of the movie where the worker gets like ripped apart by the raptor when they're trying to put it in the pen?
Yeah, but there was a lot more gore.
Wow, yeah, I don't think anyone knows about that. That's
crazy. But the highlight to me was that Spielberg broke his glasses. And, you know, most of it was filmed inside a Quonset hut, Universal Studio set, and they just put mud down and trees and stuff. And to have him go to the optometrist would be so costly, the delay in the production for even 2 hours, that they got an optometrist to move his entire shop down into the Quonset hut.
Oh, my God.
So the guy fabricated the glasses right there. Spielberg could keep working. And his mother, you know, owned a deli in Los Angeles. And every morning she would come, and his little old lady, and somebody would put her on a chair and carry her across the mud, like a, you know, sedan chair in the jungle. So, to kiss her son and then go home.
That's great.
So that's the kind of stuff I really enjoy. even more. And a lot of the shots were composite CG shots afterwards. So an actor is playing scared with nothing but a green screen behind him. The robotics that Stan Winston did were incredibly complicated, didn't always work right. And of course, they weren't always built in their entirety. But he had some incredibly talented artists working for him. And it was fun to go to his place and see all the stuff that they were drawing. This one guy, Crash McCreary, on him.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
He was just, I was blown away. What a great artist. And then some of the sculptors, there was a guy, he was in Sedona, who made these things. You know, in those days, you had to make a clay mold. So you had to sculpt the entire dinosaur. And so when you're making a T-Rex head, even a partial part of the animal to be used in the movie, in order to make the mold of this thing, you had to have like 500 pounds of clay. So this guy, I think his name was like Mike Tursik or something. He's a very good sculptor. He made the entire T-Rex out of clay, and then it was so heavy this thing collapsed.
Oh, jeez.
So he had to do it all over again.
Oh my God.
I know. So nowadays you could do other things, but Spielberg really tried to make a big secret of how the dinosaurs were made. Being closed off makes the media go crazy. So yeah. I think he knew that. So he got way more attention than it would have otherwise for these mysterious animals and how they were made. Curiosity of how this thing was done. And nobody ever mentions that, at least the first time I saw any aspect of the dinosaurs were raptor suits with zippers on a rack. because they had to do the Ninja Turtle guys had to jump up on the counter in the kitchen to be velociraptors. You can't do that with a robot or a CG.
Yeah.
In those days. So they never advertised the fact that there were these little guys in suits. But 2020, which was a really popular news evening show, was coming to do an interview one day on the set. And, when the dinosaurs weren't in use, they put sheets over them and never let anybody see them. And they were ahead in their filming, so Spielberg needed to use the dinosaurs. He didn't want these guys to see them. Therefore, he told his PR guy, who's been around forever, Marvin Levy, tell these guys to get lost. he had to throw the crew out. So they very much guarded the secrecy of these things, as if there was a secret to guard. One of the amazing things about the movie, there's certain scenes of the dinosaurs, like at the watering hole, that I think are still amazing.
Yeah.
But the way in which Spielberg put it all together, and that there are only dinosaurs on screen for 13 minutes, you'd swear they're there all the time. that's to be part of his genius. So that was impressive.
And it saves him money that way.
Well, yeah, I don't think they could have afforded. And do you know why that movie was made so fast? So his deal with Universal was he gets a third of the gross. I think that turned out to be about $350 million. He had only 30 days to make the movie. And each day he went over would cost him $1 million.
Wow.
And some movies are filming for 9 months. So he spent 2 years storyboarding and then shot the entire movie in like 28 days. So he finished early, despite having like hurricanes in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
The opening shots. So, amazingly organized and great with kids. Really nice guy. And in the process of doing this, talking to him, I said, you can get a dinosaur named after yourself. I know scientists with, they really need the money, and there's plenty of animals to be named. And so what do you say? He said, nah. So then I got a call from one of the associate producers. You told Steven he'd get a dinosaur named after himself. He's not interested. But as for the rap party at the end of the movie, he doesn't want to give these guys cars, the usual Mercedes that they have a million of already. So why don't you name a dinosaur after all these guys, all the stars of the movie?
Oh, wow.
So I had a friend, a scientist in China, who had an armored dinosaur that he was going to publish on, and he was willing to make the name be whatever we told him. And we made a Jurassicosaurus, And then the species name, you know, like Rex, like T-Rex, the species name is second. We made it Netigoa perfectomorum. It just rolls off your tongue. And that's because the first two letters are N-E for Sam Neill, D-E for Laura Dern, G-O for Goldblum, A for Attenborough, and so on down the list of the cast. And that gives you Netigoa perfectomorum.
Never do that.
And then, right, you can't say it. Then we made bronze plaques for all these, for all the actors. So I just can imagine, I wasn't there, that, you know, Laura Dern is like, so excited, what's her present? And then she opens up this bronze plaque and like, oh, shit. This is what, I could have had a car and I got this. So I thought it was a very funny idea of Spielberg's, too.
Well, then Michael Crichton eventually got a dinosaur named after him, right?
Yeah, that was just gratitude. Yeah, Crichtonsaurus, a scientist. He actually called me at one point after the movie came out and said, I want to make a donation. And I said, oh, yeah, well, where do you want to do it? And he said, no, that's what I want you to tell me. So,
wow.
So we sent it to the professional organization for paleontology. It was like $150,000, but his condition was nobody should ever know that he gave the money. So he was a very selfless guy in some respects.
Yeah, what was it like meeting him? Like, you mentioned how you interviewed him and like met with him, but like, how was? Because I always wanted to meet him. Like, he's one of my literary heroes because I loved growing up on all of his books, all of them, like even like Sphere and Congo and Timeline, you know?
Right. Well, you know, we got to be friendly, so I would go to his office sometimes. He had a little house in Santa Monica that he barely fit into. Even his assistant, you know, he was 6'9".
Wow.
And so he's an imposing guy and you know, brilliant. He didn't enjoy writing. For instance, he was obligated to make the sequel to Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
he was way overdue on the getting it done. And then he finally went to some bungalow of his in Hawaii and wrote the whole thing in a weekend.
Oh, my God.
No, he was a fascinating guy. And, you know, he loved to take contrary positions and investigate the background for it. And he really did a good job overall on his homework about dinosaurs. You know, he invented some stuff for dramatic reasons, but if you go back and look at it for a guy who, you know, he's not at all a student of paleontology, he picked up a lot very quickly. He was great in that way. He was very shy. And I induced him to host a NOVA about the science, in quotes, of Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah.
And he was so awkward, so uneasy for a guy who's very polished and personable. He just was terrified of the camera. And so he came out pretty wooden, I'm afraid. You know, he hated directing. He had directed, I forget what he directed, you probably know.
Yeah, he directed Westworld and Coma and Eternal Man. Yeah, Eternal Man.
Yeah, so he said he found the actors impossible human beings, and he didn't enjoy it. He was like the solitary life much more than the collaboration. One day I was with them on the set, and Crichton would come to visit once or twice. And they were talking about CG and its novelty then and its possible applications. And Spielberg said, you know, in 20 years, maybe we can do without actors entirely. And Crichton was so excited. He was like, oh, wow, that'd be great. And then Spielberg said, you know, Michael, this is going to be the first billion-dollar movie. And Crichton said, nah, I don't think so. Of course, it was. So, at the time I knew him, he just was together with a woman who wrote, what's the tornado movie with him? And he hadn't yet had a kid, but he also wasn't inordinately wealthy. I mean, he made like $1 million from the rights to the movie, and it probably made $1 million or $2 million from the book. But compared to Spielberg, nothing. So he said, you know, Steven would call me and say, let's go to Hawaii together. Crichton said, I can't afford to go on a private airplane. So, and I can't fit in a commercial airliner very well. You know, there were levels of wealth, and he didn't see himself then. But I think after ER, he really became a very wealthy guy, too, and an art collector. And but he was he was always a very curious guy and very insightful in all things. And and unfortunately, he and I both suffer from depression, and so there was there were things to talk about. And he, you know, he because he knew medicine so well, he'd been a doctor. He was trying what then were treatments, you know, medications that other people had investigated. And I assume it was pretty successful because he remained productive, you know. But he had his struggles and he smoked like a chimney. And I'm afraid that contributed to his early death.
Yeah, he left way too soon.
So it was during this time that they were talking about making the ride. You know, they're always thinking well in advance of what, how they're going to convert the movie. So it wasn't long after that that I met the Gary Goddard team and then was, in quotes, working on the ride. There wasn't much work to be done on my part. So to work on his project, the same people in Hollywood, in the theme park business, I'm sure in other aspects too, you know, they work for many companies.
Yeah.
They cycle. Somebody's making that film, then they go to the other production house. So a guy who had originally, I don't remember his name, produced sort of first concept for Jurassic Park, he hired him. And then Universal sort of had to go to Gary Goddard.
But it makes sense because I know it was originally going to be a Jeep ride, which he does talk about, but he doesn't say like who kind of started that idea. But eventually he came up with the river ride idea. That's what took over. So maybe right. The original guy started with the Jeep version and then like swooped in and took it away kind of thing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I did choose the guys to make the rhinoceros. Well, they were really supposed to be triceratops, but they seemed more like rhinoceros. You know the robotic triceratops that were in the visitor center?
Yeah.
They were the most sophisticated dinosaurs ever built. But they wanted a, for the show, a very prescribed, limited set of movements. Those animals could like do everything but climb steps. They could respond to your facial expressions. You know, if you were scared, they would back off. If you did something menacing, they would be aggressive. They were amazing. They were done by a crazy friend of mine named Paul Train. And he worked with, I forgot the name of it, the Canadian company that built the lunar lander. So it was the most over-engineered robot ever built. I think it was like a $13 million project for two animals. And then they, you know, I think the show was kind of dopey, and they didn't make much use of those of the animals. So I wondered what happened to them afterwards, because eventually they retired them.
You know? Yeah, the Triceratops encounter, right?
Right, exactly. So they made a new show, and so when I was at Universal, I just walking around there, I asked some guys in the ride who's working there. So you know, where are those Triceratops? And he said, "Oh, they're on a farm breeding." You don't have to stay in character here. Where are the goddamn robots? I think he didn't know. So he never learned what happened to them. That was a waste and a shame. I would love to rehabilitate those animals.
Yeah, I think the whole area is leveled now because they're building, of all things, a big roller coaster that's kind of going to weave throughout that land in Florida.
Right.
Yeah, it's a shame. Because, yeah, I'd been retired for a long time, and I think I found, like, a video online of someone, like, sneaking into the abandoned area. And I don't think they saw the animatronics there, but they saw, like, the place where they were. So, yeah, someone moved them somewhere. But, yeah, who knows where
they could be. Oh, there's a great story about when they opened the ride that I don't think people know. So they had already built the dinosaurs, the robots, into the building, and the ones that were outside as well. Phil Hedema, who was then running things for the ride, had asked me who they should get to build these things. For whatever reason, they went with a little bidder, some company, I think, in Utah. And that's why like, the skins of all the dinosaurs would rip all the time, the ones outside. And the cool story is that they wanted to have an opening for this that would showcase the dinosaurs, but they're all inside the building. And so they took a Dynamation, robotic dinosaur, whatever robots were around in those days, of a T-Rex, about 40 feet, attached it to a helicopter, and dropped it in to the top of the building. And as soon as all the crew, all the, you know, news crews left, they lifted it out again because it had nothing to do with the exhibition. They just wanted people to be able to see a dinosaur. So they rented this one for a day. And then, you know, all the work had been done, but they wanted to show workers, you know, out putting it all together. So, but they decided that the actual workers were too ugly. So they hired models, male models, to play the construction workers.
What?
Just for the benefit of the news pictures.
Oh, we got beautiful people working on this ride. Look at them.
That's right. Everybody in Hollywood is beautiful, including the workmen.
God, everything's fake.
So actually, my contribution to that in material fact, the making of it was so limited to like what plants they put inside to try to make them of that time that are existing now with ancestors in the Jurassic or Cretaceous. And then I hate rides, so I hope I don't offend you.
No, not for everybody.
I'm terrified of them. So I never went on it. So
oh my God.
The night they were opening it, one of the real workmen, who was like 300 pounds, who I knew from hanging out there, said, "Did you go on that ride yet?" And I said, "No, no way I'm going on that ride." So he picked me up and he threw me in the ride. Well, that's literally. So that's why I know what it's like to fall 80 feet into the water.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant feeling, but it is thrilling to me anyway. Yeah.
The opening sort of event where they had, I don't know, the ride I think attracts a lot more of the Hollywood celebrities than the opening of a movie.
Yeah.
So there were guys like David Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
and then there's this one guy who's going on the ride over and over and over again. He's soaking wet. And everybody else, you know, went on the ride and they're eating the food and talking. And he's just going around and around and around by himself. He's got long stringy hair. They said, "Who is that guy? What's his problem?" And they said, "That's Paul Allen. Yeah. The guy who owned every team in Seattle and was the number two at Microsoft and was a billionaire." That's all he did was go around and around on the ride.
He's like a thrill junkie. Well, you were also part of the Q videos that would play
right
on the screen. Yeah. How
Thank you
that?
Very much. I realize why I'm not the guy in the movies. Ever. Right. No, that was fun. I mean, it was just a couple of days of shooting out in some swamp. And it was a lot of fun. And they let me pretty much talk about what I wanted to talk about. So that made it easier as well.
Yeah, I love that kind of in-universe kind of feel that they made with those Q videos. And I think you fit right in. You're still one of the beautiful people. You know, you're not like one of those people that get weak.
No. I'm one of the science people. They're not supposed to be beautiful. They're just supposed to be nerdy people, awkward on camera. So I was born for that role. Oh, and this is a good story, I think. So Universal had all these flats attached to the movie, you know, the suits who were always doing nothing, going around monitoring everything to see that their dollars are well spent or whatever, you know. And they have this whole marketing division that's looking for every single way to make a dime out of stuff. The guy who was in charge of marketing at that time was actually a really nice guy. His name was something Marshall, no relation to Kathy Kennedy's Frank Marshall. But this guy, was very interested in the fact that I had done an exhibit. And he thought, oh, well, maybe we could open a whole division of exhibits for Universal. And I said, well, I don't think I want to do this. He said, well, no, we'll give you an office here. You know, we'll give you a big salary. And I said, well, what's the first exhibit that you want to do? And he said, the making of a theme park. And I said, okay, I'm out. There was one woman who was in the business then who was quite successful at doing exhibits. Her name was Stacy Fishkin. And I said, why don't you call this woman? She likes to do this kind of thing. She just did an exhibit that Pfizer sponsored for the drug industry, which to me was like being a museum hoe, you know, to sell out to the drug company. So I said, why don't you interview her? So I came to the meeting, and there was a guy there named Eddie Newquist, who's still active in the business, but he was sort of a designer person at Universal, in-house guy. He was sitting on the meeting, this guy who ran it, and Stacy Bishkin came in a skirt that was just about up to her navel and sat down right in front of the guy, and I'm sitting in the back, and she's totally ignoring me, and I'm the person who got her the job, basically, but because she thought I was the competition.
Oh.
And then this guy, Eddie Newquist, I think went and ended up working for her. They did this exhibit. It wasn't very popular. But the most interesting part of the story to me was that, do you know a movie called All About Eve that was made in the 30s?
Yeah.
You know, then the woman is conniving as a Betty Davis's assistant who works her way up to being a star?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that still in Hollywood. So there was a secretary in the department. And in those days, you wrote a memo, you typed it up, and you put it on somebody's desk. You know, that's how things were communicated. So I had an idea that I presented to this guy, Marshall, that to keep the franchise in people's minds between movies, because you only make a movie every 3 years on average,
yeah,
there's a new generation of kids, the people are somewhat creating a new story. But in between, let's create this Jurassic Institute, and we'll have a presence online, and we'll partner with a publishing company and create books with the Jurassic Park imprimatur about dinosaurs. And so, you know, people will associate Jurassic Park with the real science. They'll see the Jurassic Park name in places still. So they like that idea. But when I walked into this, I wrote a two-page memo presenting this thing and left it on this guy's desk. I came back, I don't know, after a week or so back to Los Angeles, and I see the memo, but on top of it is not my name, but the secretary's name and her friend.
Oh, my and God.
They took the memo off his desk, rewrote it with their, just put their names on the top, and said that this was their concept.
That's bullshit.
I know. So I, you know, I called her up and I said, you asshole, what are you doing? And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, she ended up the president of licensing for Universal, Stephanie Sperber. So she wormed her way from like the secretary to the president. I think she's since retired, but came back to haunt me because when they made the first Jurassic World, I thought, okay, I'll propose an exhibit. And Marvin and Levy was still there representing Amblin, the PR guy. And I thought, well, we could team up. The first two were very successful. I went to give a presentation, only the decision about which exhibit proposal to accept was to be made by Stephanie Sperber, who hadn't forgotten, and I had told her she was an asshole. So even though we had a really cool concept and it would have been some really interesting 3D projection, it would have been a great exhibit, they ended up working instead with a guy who used to work for me, and you know, she knew that I didn't get along with that guy, so it made it all the more attractive to hire him instead. So this guy put together a concept for an $8 million exhibit, which is quite expensive for these kind of things and hard to recoup the money for. But in part because he was going to work with guys I had worked with on a deal that this fellow drove south, which was the guys in Australia named Creatures Technology that made the very effective combination of inflatable, animatronic, and robotic dinosaurs for the Walking with Dinosaurs arena tour.
Oh, yeah.
And that's very, very well done. And so the concept was to use their animals, which were quite expensive, in this touring exhibit. Unfortunately, the guy who had worked for me was, you know, not very interested in content and just made sort of a promo for the movie using those animals. It played in like four places in the world, three or four. It was too expensive for museums to show, and then was sold to a Korean company, I don't know their name, which I don't know what they do with this thing. So it was a very underutilized exhibition and some very cool robots. You know, the way theirs work is like when the Muppets did dinosaurs. you have a puppeteer wears a glove, you know, and he controls the facial movements in person. So the animal has some basic mechanical movements, often has a person underneath doing the gross body movements, but then it can, you know, it has gestures and expressions that make it seem very much alive because some guy is programming it at that moment. So that was another lost bit of cool dinosaur technology.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't pan out that way, but at least your exhibits, you know, like especially looking at that video that I uploaded of the San Diego exhibit that I went to, I shot that myself when I was like, I don't know, like 10 or 11 or something. And
wow.
Yeah, I was like, I think I might want this someday. But it was so cool because it had like all those big array of dinosaur skeletons, you know, even had the Giganotosaurus and the Mimichosaurus and, you know, even a number of the Stan Winston animatronics and storyboards. So it was like a wall of storyboards. And and I remember there was even that little video of you with the Deinonychus skull.
Yeah, that was, you know, Pepper's Ghost. It was just a little box, but it was very cool.
There was the Extinction Theater where it had like the large screen video with Jeff Goldblum, you know, reprising his role as Ian Malcolm. And it, you know, it included like shaking lights and smoke effects when like the asteroid hit. So how involved were you with that?
Well, that was my design, my concept. The whole exhibit was, you know, I designed the exhibit and then I find the people who can do those things. So there was a company where I was in Boston that did exhibit design called Boston Productions, I think, and they said, can you do these various things and make them happen? You know, so I had seen the Pepper's Ghost effect. Of course, it's at Disney everywhere, but I had seen it used in a little box in the American Museum in a display about Native Americans, and the researchers were going in and out of a little house in 3D that way. So I found the guy who did that and had him create the dinosaur effect. The lines that Goldblum said, though, I had scripted for him, but he rewrote them into Jeff Goldblum speak, you know? Like, he's well aware of how eccentric his speech pattern is. So he showed up on this little set we had made with an assistant, wardrobe person, with 19 identical black T-shirts. I'm still trying to figure that out. And then we gave him the script, and he, you know, took out a pen, and he rewrote it, and it was great. It was much more like what he would sound like. So the whole thing. I wrote the signs, the script of the movie short things and everything else. That's the fun of it.
Yeah, of course. No, that's perfect.
So it opened in the American Museum. Before, the week they're making it, we're laying out the forest and everything there, and it was all done, and I come back for the premiere that evening, and there's a Mercedes Jeep in the middle of the jungle. And I said, what's that doing? And they said, oh, we got them as a sponsor. So it's not only not the Jeep in the movie, but I wasn't about doing commercials, you know? So and then it got reviewed in the New York Times, which criticized it for being too commercial, and the American Museum said, oh, that was lesson.
Oh, God.
It's not just in Hollywood that these things go on. But the scientists there were great to work with, and they had a lot of influence. And they were instrumental in selecting, you know, which dinosaurs represent which time periods and stuff, which was fun to do.
Yeah, it seemed like it encompassed like a whole, like array of dinosaurs from all the different time periods. It wasn't just like focused on just the Jurassic Park dinosaurs, which I remember, you know, appreciating, you know, as a kid. And I love like the little little eggs that looked like there was like a little baby dinosaur inside where, you know, mm-hmm. part of it was like open in the case. I love seeing those.
I still have that Mimichosaur that you saw, the giant plant eater.
Oh my God.
But you know, it's falling apart. So the trunk of his body is sitting in the goat pen here. And his head is coming out of the barn. And his tail is coming out the other end. So we kind of repurposed him.
That's amazing. I was wondering if you like kept anything or if anything like survived from any of the Jurassic Park exhibits. I'm surprised the biggest one is what survived.
Well, it was was not robotized, so it didn't have moving parts or anything in it. I wouldn't say survived well, but it survived. For a while, I had a Velociraptor. You know, I had the molds from Universal. They had given them to me to make them as needed for the theme park and in the exhibits. So we didn't put any soft parts or hydraulic fluid in them like Winston would do. But we made, you know, an armature and a shell. And so I had some of the raptors from the exhibit after it closed outside. And, you know, they weather and the foam starts to fall apart. And after a while, it turned to crap. But I knew a guy who could fix them up. And then I have one raptor that I fixed up and put in the touring exhibit now. So I have that and the Stegosaurus, the Pachycephalosaur from the Lost World.
Yeah.
And I have a Brachiosaur head and neck. Those are the only things from the movie that I retained.